I see it there. So, all right. So welcome to Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods. Every month we take a deep dive into the theology, the history, and the social issues of various cults. From the infamous to the most famous, we look at exactly how these groups operate, why people are drawn to them, and how they differ from the true Christian teachings.
Through careful research and analysis, we aim to shed light on the complex and often controversial world of cults, and to provide insight into the unique challenges that they pose to individuals, families, and society as a whole. So whether you're a curious bystander, a former member, or you're simply interested in the intersection of religion and culture, we invite you to join us on this journey of discovery and understanding.
And while you're here, you know, help us out. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe right on YouTube to always stay up to date with our latest content. And as always, we thank you for joining us in this exploration of faith, frauds, and falsehoods.
Now, before we get started, let us be clear. The opinions that we present are ours alone. They do not represent the views or opinions of our respective churches or employers. Now, let's begin.
Cool. So here we are again, Matt. It's been a little while since our last recording. I think we recorded, I don't know, last week. And we talked about a beginning cult, right, of future humanity, the direction that things are going. And that was certainly interesting. If you haven't watched our Future Humanity episode yet, go take a look. There's a lot there, a lot of potential danger on the horizon.
Well, and those who are watching us on live stream right now, they probably haven't got the chance to see it.
They have no idea.
Yet, right?
That's right. Oh, that's true, because it's not out yet since we're live streaming. Yeah. It comes out on Wednesday for those of you that are following us on the live streams. Today's Monday. It'll be here on Wednesday.
Y'all might be wondering why we're live streaming. Well, we decided a while back we were going to start live streaming. When we do a cult, we do it in four episodes, right? Mm-hmm. 3 to 4 episodes. Right. And we decided our first episode for the history, we were going to start live streaming that episode, kind of. No, just for fun. Yep. But we forgot to do it last time, so we decided to start doing it this time. And we actually forgot and restarted this one so we could start doing it this time.
Yeah, so it's a little later than we usually get started, but
yeah,
that's okay.
We were going to start 45 minutes ago.
You know, as always happens with us, we go down rabbit trails and we talk and we talk and we talk some more.
Yeah.
So who are we talking about, Matt? What's the plan? What are we doing?
So this month we're talking about the FLDS, the Fundamentalist Latter-day Saints. Warren Jeffs is the name that a lot of people know. And we're going to talk a lot about Warren Jeffs' reign as the leader of the FLDS. He's still
That's
the leader
good word
of the
for
FLDS.
It. Yep.
What, reign?
Yep. Yep. Reign is a good word.
So the FLDS is an offshoot of the LDS, the Latter-day Saints, or mm-hmm. otherwise known as the Mormon Church.
Mormons, yep.
So let's kind of just start from the schism there. Now, we've talked mm-hmm. about, you know, especially with this one, because this tracks back to another group, and there's kind of several different schisms. We've talked about exploring that more, and so we're going to explore more of groups connected to this group, where it came from, and et cetera, in the future. But for today, we're going to start off with the FLDS in particular.
Yep, the big name, the one that most everyone's going to know.
They originally started out as a schism from the LDS, mainly over polygamy. There's some other things to do with it too.
Yeah, it was like very late 1800s, like 1888, 1890, something like that, that the declaration opposing polygamy came out from the LDS, and this group started saying, no, we want polygamy.
Well, polygamy was something that originally came, you know, early on in the Mormon Church, and it was something that a lot of people in society had trouble with. So, we'll go over the history of the LDS later, but it was a very controversial thing. And this particular was tied to the issue of statehood for Utah. Right. The Mormons pretty much controlled Utah at that point in time, the Utah Territory. As a matter of fact, the head of the Mormon Church was also the governor of the territory.
Right.
And it's kind of a concession. Some say a concession. According to the church, it was a prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
There was what was called the first manifesto issued by the president and prophet of the church, Wilford Woodruff, in 1890. And he basically said polygamy was done for. Any existing polygamous marriages were fine. Old Wilford had several wives himself. But any new marriages would no longer be approved to be polygamous.
Right.
And that's what it started. Then in 1902, which is what, 12 years later, Joseph mm-hmm. F. Smith, a descendant from Joseph Smith, but not Joseph Smith.
Right.
Came out with the second manifesto.
Great-grandson. Yep.
Yeah. And very importantly, he reinforced what the first manifesto said, but he said that all plural marriages should cease, including existing ones.
Okay.
That was very controversial.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, it didn't just end all these plural marriages. There are even people who still had more plural marriages afterwards. Mm-hmm. And we'll go more into it when we talk about the social issues about plural marriage.
Right, yeah. But and the theology, because there's a lot around the theology as well.
Oh, yes. Because a woman's salvation is through her husband, and he can only achieve certain levels if he's married to at least three women.
Yep.
So this was a practice of the LDS at the time, but they rejected that. And some members were not for that. Even some members who stayed in leadership in the church
mm-hmm.
were not for that. Some just quit teaching it, but they still believed in it. Some, you know, taught against it because that was the teaching of the church at the time.
Right.
A lot of people track back. So there were several groups that left the LDS and kind of splintered off to them. Because after the second manifesto, it was like, okay, guys, you guys really don't belong. Now, it still took a little while.
Mm-hmm.
10 years later, they still had people who were practicing polygamy in the LDS church.
Right.
It wasn't like a one and done thing. And this Lauren C. Woolley, he's going to come up in several groups we discuss.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of people in religion, he ended up forming a few different things. And a lot of the groups that are considered more fundamentalist groups, more like the FLDS, they're the largest of the fundamentalist groups, but they're not the mm-hmm. only one.
Right.
They track back to Lauren C. Woolley,
yep.
As the founder of them, that he was the leader. His statement where he rejected the 1890 manifesto, he says that there was a previous thing said that when Wilford Woodruff made that, it was a political reasons. It wasn't a word from God.
Now, right.
Again, even to cover history, we have to talk about how they believe things.
Yes.
So they believe they have a president and a mm-hmm. prophet who are usually yep. the same person. There's some changes there too. Thoughts?
I'm trying to think if there's any instance specifically in the FLDS where it's not one man.
Not since, in the FLDS.
Right. I was going to say, because the one man doctrine was pushed really hard by Johnson. Very early on. I think it was Johnson.
Yeah, not in the FLDS. That was pretty evident.
Right.
But in the LDS, there were some changes and things. But my point is, they believe that when the prophet speaks, they're speaking from God.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty big deal. This is not like us Baptists who can argue about everything. You know, you
right.
preacher get up there and say something we don't like, we'll send you down the road. We'll just have a vote. Eat a casserole when we're done, okay?
Right.
But they you know, their prophet speaks for God. And,
right.
and it's important yep. to notice, again, I know we're covering history, but I want to note that most Christian denominations don't consider the LDS a Christian denomination, but
right.
they consider themselves a Christian denomination. And that's because of where they split. We'll cover that more in the LDS stuff. But as the FLDS split off, it was mainly through this Lauren C. Woolley. Now, there's some mm-hmm. argument of who succeeded him next. This is where there was a splintering of the different groups.
Right.
He was leading things, and There's some argument about where, but what we know for sure about the FLDS is that ultimately Leroy S. Johnson became the leader. He was known as Uncle Roy.
Yep.
And then his son, not his son, then Rulon Jess became the leader.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, the star of this little...
Right, the name that everyone knows.
became Warren. Yeah, the star of the shindig became Warren Jess, his son.
Yep.
Another thing, we talk about the polygamy, but what was very important was it wasn't just about polygamy.
Right.
Did you want to speak to that a little bit about the communal aspect?
So they became very, really the best word that I've seen used for it is communist, right? You've got one man leading the show, telling everyone what to do, how to live, what to grow, what to provide for each other, right? Very agrarian society, right? That's led by one man.
The United Order.
Right.
Now, yeah, this is something that was tried originally with the LDS at one point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because originally, right, even the FLDS started with four guys, right, that were kind of the elders, the leaders, until one of them died. And I think it was Johnson. I had my notes on my theology side. Johnson, I'm pretty sure it was Johnson. I don't have his name written down. Johnson declared the one-man doctrine to be enforced, right, which was a teaching previously in the LDS church that had kind of also been dropped, that there was only one person at any given time that was to speak for God, right? That was their prophet. That was the one person that you followed. And so when he applied this doctrine, he didn't replace the guy who died. Right. And then shortly thereafter, he booted out the other two. Right. So he kind of took total control in that very communist kind of way.
It is the way a lot of communist things have played out, you know, isn't it?
It is. You know, it's all let's come together as a community and then boom, let's boot everybody out and take control. And that's really the best way that I've seen it described is communism in action in a small group. It's what you see.
Well, and their group started growing. Some interesting, just a little bit of, as we're going down the timeline here, you see my note about April 14th there.
Yeah.
Which I'm actually jumping ahead. Let me start in 1929, because we're talking about the splitting of the groups and all this.
Mm-hmm.
The formation of what was called the Short Creek Community. This later becomes the FLDS stronghold. Basically, a lot of people who were in the LDS and believed in the old ways ended up moving to or already were in the Short Creek Community.
Mm-hmm. Which was right on the line of Utah and Arizona, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So yes.
It was right there.
Hilldale
and Colorado City. Yeah.
Yep.
So it's kind of a Twin City thing. We know about Twin Cities. We're from a Twin City.
Yep.
But they all called it Short Creek or Short Creek.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where they lived. So for generations, literally, you know, they kind of were left there. They were mostly left alone.
Mm-hmm.
Rulon Jeffs, his dad was LDS, but didn't actually teach him about it. He didn't know his dad growing up. And when he met his dad later, his dad taught him about the LDS church. And he went to an LDS business school, became an accountant.
Okay.
Worked for the state of Utah. Well, as he started learning, he got in with these FLDS people. They weren't calling themselves that necessarily at the time, but the more fundamentalists. And he decided he wanted to do plural marriage. His first wife, Zola, didn't want nothing to do with that mess.
Right.
They had a couple of kids, and he told her, I'm going to start marrying other women. And she's like, nope, I'm out of here.
Yep.
So she hauled off and left him, took his kids and went to Sacramento, and then he married the next girl. mm-hmm. the next one, and the next one.
And the next one, and the next one. Yep.
But in 1953, Arizona did a raid on the Short Creek community.
Right.
They went around finding people who were living as polygamists. Now, most of these polygamists get away with it because they only legally marry the first wife.
Right.
Then they and just then live.
Ritually marry the others. Yep.
Right. And very important about this raid is that it was thought that the LDS church leaders had told on the FLDS people, basically.
Right. Now, let's be clear about the word raid. Right. We're not talking a Waco style raid.
As they went house to house.
I mean, house to house, but they weren't showing up, you know, with the full military ready to mow everything down, were they?
They rounded people up and took them to jail, that's for sure. It was more like an immigration raid.
So, more like an immigration raid. Okay. All right. Makes sense.
Was illegal. Matter of fact, something I kind of left out earlier is, you know, the church decided polygamy wasn't part of their beliefs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
When Utah became a state, was it 1889, something like that? It was actually Congress made them write it in their constitution because polygamy was illegal in territories. All the territories were ruled by territorial law. So Congress mm-hmm. ruled them. When they become a state, they could set their own laws.
Right.
But in order to agree for them to become a state, Congress made them put it in their constitution that polygamous marriage would be illegal forever in Utah.
Okay.
So it's ironic because when we think of Utah, we think about polygamy. But actually, it's illegal by their constitution there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was actually Arizona who was raiding. And basically, they didn't like these Mormons. They didn't like what they did. They didn't like that they had all these different wives. I will tell you, it was much more common to marry young women back then. It wasn't mm-hmm. super uncommon for a 14-year-old and definitely not uncommon for a 16-year-old to get married.
Right.
Back in the, you know, 1920s and 1800s, mm-hmm. even in 1953, it happened quite a lot. I mean, we've probably got grandmothers who were married pretty young. I don't know about yours.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that wasn't super uncommon culturally. I'm not saying that was right, because obviously our culture thinks differently nowadays. You know, if I had a daughter and somebody tried to marry her at 14, well, they wouldn't be able to complete
might have
that.
A problem. Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
I might have a short prison sentence, but hey, we'd take care of that. What's a good podcast if I didn't threaten to murder somebody?
Right. Oh, dear.
But anyways, they raided there. The state was trying to wipe out polygamy. They were trying to make sure that wasn't around. That was a blot on society, right? But it wasn't very successful.
Right.
They got arrested. No. They went back home and they just kind of kept growing.
And they kept, yep.
And they just went around it, you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
I saw some numbers as high as, what, like 30,000 adherents at one point?
Oh, I've seen higher numbers. LDS?
Higher numbers?
70, 80,000.
Okay.
At one time. It's hard to check these things.
Right.
Because these people were generally kept to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So let's, again, I'm trying not to cover the history here, but, you know, one of the things we talked about, the United Order. So they didn't live on one big commune, but Short Creek was one of their bases they lived at. Later on, they formed some other places we'll talk about. They were also living in other parts of Utah and near Salt Lake City mm-hmm. and such.
Right.
And actually, Rulon rarely lived in Short Creek. He did for a little while.
Yeah.
But rarely. Most of his life, he didn't spend there.
Right.
He actually lived outside Salt Lake City and would take a private plane to Short Creek even after he was the leader there. But that was kind of their base of operations.
Mm-hmm.
Later, when Leroy Johnson died in 1986, that's when Rulon just became president.
Right.
They further separated from their beliefs of the LDS Church. They had already been excommunicated mm-hmm. way back in 1935.
Right.
They weren't part of the LDS Church, but they still believed a lot alike. And Rulon really pushed this whole united effort, united order thing. That is actually a long-standing LDS thing, and he was the founder of the longest-running one in modern history. It's still running to this day, as a matter of fact, to some extent.
Right.
Yeah. Basically, it was the communal living. They all shared their resources. They had a church storehouse where they would, you know, all have resources like clothing and food and things all put together. Also, they're legal. Like, these people are educated. They own universities. The LDS run the Brigham Young University. We know people who graduated from there.
Yep.
Who serve in Baptist denominations, which is interesting, right?
Right.
But they formed a trust, and the trust owned almost all the land in Short Creek on both sides of the state line. The houses, the businesses, the trust owned most all of that. Rulon Jeffs was instrumental in putting that together. So as their group was growing, they also grow fast because they have a lot of kids.
Right.
Rulon Jeffs, I want to say he had like 90-something kids. It's crazy. when you have all those wives and they all have kids and they don't believe in birth control.
Right.
I mean, the man must be exhausted. But
I've got four a lot of kids. I'm exhausted.
Right. just keeping up with the four.
Right.
But my point was they were growing as a group. Mm-hmm. He would have the men, they would all work together, and they would work in company businesses. We've heard that from other cults before.
Yep.
They ran construction. One famous one is Face Construction. They actually ran a machine shop and made parts that they've sold parts for to the U.S. military and the Department of Defense. They made millions of dollars doing such a thing.
Right.
And Rulon really pushed this. He really did this. And so he started in 1986. We're going to go back a little bit. We're going to jump to 1976. See, Rulon was important in the church for a long time, but he didn't become the prophet until 1986. His son, Warren, he was a principal. He became principal of the Alta Academy.
Yep.
Now, this was in the suburb of Salt Lake City where Rulon lived and where Warren lived. Mm-hmm. They had some believers who lived there, and they had an academy called Alta Academy. It was a school ran by the FLDS for their FLDS kids. So they're real big about keeping them out of the society. They don't have radios. They don't have televisions. They live in their own society. They may interact with some of the businesses they run, but for the most part, they don't interact with the rest of society.
Right.
He was the principal of that school from 1976 to 1976. 76 to 96. So that's like 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And in that 20 years, there were actually quite a few issues presented, right, of him having potential misconduct and potential issues. I saw one article that called him a perverted old man, right? Which, you know, as we get to the social issues around Warren Jeffs, I think all of us will agree he's a perverted old man.
Well, it was during those years whenever he was accused of molesting his own children.
Right.
And his siblings' children, both boys and girls. While he was principal of that, you know, he was in a position of power over all these young children.
Yep.
And people in the church who heard about this or seen weird things happening just sort of, well, that's Warren. They just sort of pushed him to the side. While at the same time they were teaching purity and, you know, waiting for marriage and all this. Yeah, like you said, he was a perverted old man. And we'll go more into that when we do that. Yeah. But it was but he was a principal for 20 years. Now, I think it's important to notice also, I don't think he was ever certified as a principal. Like, I don't think he's actually educated for that. I'm not sure what his education was, but I do know they had no certified teachers there at all.
Right. Yeah, because I mean, you don't have to be a certified teacher to use, you know, homeschool curriculum and whatnot. So who knows what they were using. And what Utah's regulations were at that point.
His own daughter, Rachel Jeffs, wrote a book about surviving the cult and surviving him.
Oh, yeah.
She was one of the people that he molested as a little girl while she went to that school. And also, he would just arbitrarily find reasons for her to not go to school and expel her and her sisters sometimes. But even so, they only went to eighth grade. The school went further, but they were only allowed to go to eighth grade.
Right.
And then she became a teacher after that. I started teaching third grade. So she was a teenager teaching classes there.
Right.
Yeah. So it was not a good school at all.
No.
In 2002, so that was 96. So, Rulon started getting sick. He had a stroke and it really caused him a lot of trouble. Now Rulon had a bunch of kids and there was no like strict succession that said, oh, the oldest son gets this. And Warren is not even his oldest son by far.
Right.
But Warren stepped up and started helping his dad. And he even moved his family from where they were living outside of Salt Lake City to Short Creek, where where Rulon had moved, and where most of his wives were at. And he started helping out his dad. And effectively, he was running the church because he was the voice for his dad. He was the one who told other people what his dad said. As the president and the prophet, Rulon was the one who married everybody and would say who was going to marry who.
Right.
But since he couldn't talk and speak real well and communicate real well, Warren took over doing this. And he actually started marrying a whole bunch of people to his dad. His dad had a whole bunch of wives as it was. But Warren started marrying younger and younger girls to his dad. And saying, oh yeah, he wants you to marry him, and just marrying off these girls. As young as 14 at that time. And that's going to be important here in a couple minutes when we get down the timeline here. So eventually, his dad dies.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what he said when his dad died?
I don't.
He said he didn't have a lot to say right then. But he was telling them right now, hands off his dad's wives.
Okay.
He was marrying all these girls to his dad. His dad had 60-something wives. And
perverted old man.
First thing he said was, hands off his dad's wives. Now, he already had several wives himself.
Yeah.
And that was the first thing he said. Well, very shortly afterwards, in 2002, he took over as the president and the prophet.
Yep.
And he immediately married all but two of his dad's wives.
Right. And those two, because they left.
Well, one refused to marry him, so she was forbidden from marrying anybody else, but she was still taken care of as part of the church. I think it was because she was an older wife and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, yes, she left.
Right.
And left to tell her story.
So I sent you this message the other day, right? Because I was reading through one of my articles and this came up. And, you know, I told you, you know, Paul said something pretty specifically about this particular type of sin. Do you know what Paul told the church to do with that person?
Which person?
That man, with the man who was marrying his father's wives.
What did Paul tell us to do?
Paul told the church of Corinth to send them out and give them to Satan. Just straight up excommunicate them, full force, cut off all action to the community. Right? No connection whatsoever.
Just interesting, because that was also a practice the FLDS had, not for that same sin.
Of course.
But their prophet would often excommunicate people. Mm-hmm. And then from that point on, they were a non-member, and no members were allowed to talk to them, to acknowledge them. They had to cut them out of pictures. We've heard this from other cults as well before.
Yep.
That was a common thing. I'm going to mute my mic for a second because I got a cough.
Yeah. So we're up to 2004, you know. So there was a location in Texas, El Dorado, Texas, down south, where people started moving to. Called Yearning Fort. Is that how you pronounce that?
Yearning for Zion Ranch.
Yearning for Zion Ranch. Okay. All right. You've got it spelled wrong.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's not uncommon. Yes. The Yearning for Zion Ranch. So
that was a smaller group, right?
No. Well, sort of. The heat was on in Short Creek.
Right.
They owned most of all of Short Creek, including, by the way, the mayor of Short Creek, the whole political structure, the police force. That's important later when we talk about social issues. While they didn't necessarily own the police force, because you can't do that, almost everybody who worked for the police force were FLDS members.
Right.
And they would very much follow Warren Jess before they'd follow any law.
Of course.
And that was true for years and years and years, and is still somewhat true now. And so Warren decided that they had a few other groups of believers in other parts of the country. They had a group in Mexico, a group in Canada, and different places. But he decided that, he said the Lord spoke to him. Right. He needed another place. So he started driving around trying to find another place. And he ended up in El Dorado, Texas, outside of El Dorado, Texas. And he bought this land. He formed Yearning for Zion Ranch and built a big, beautiful temple there. It's an LDS tradition to build beautiful temples. And, man, he just went crazy there. So he decided this was the place. Now, there's a long history. We'll talk about that when we cover the LDS of Zion in the LDS movement. And he decided he was gonna do Zion again. And this was this Yearning for Zion Ranch. This was the Holy Land. And only certain people would be worthy of moving there. Not even everybody in his family was worthy of moving there. And he didn't move there full time. Matter of fact, he rarely lived there because he was on the run. He moved between places.
Yep.
Where have we heard that from before too? Tony Alamo.
No, Tony Alamo. Jim Jones.
Jim Jones did that. Moved around between different places. It's almost like they're all playing from a playbook.
Yeah.
I wonder where they could get a playbook of evil. But anyways.
Anyway.
It's as if they're being controlled. I don't know.
Right. I don't know.
But he moved around a lot. But he built this huge temple out there, moved a bunch of people. It was some rough land, but they turned it into quite a settlement. They built houses. Yeah. Again, we'll cover more of the social things. They were on a strict schedule of building fast. And they have to build big houses. They got families with, you know, five wives and, you know, 30 children and stuff like that. Yeah, so
Jeff's big house. Jeff's, his house was, what, like 28,000 square feet or something?
Yeah, I want to say he had...
It was huge. I mean, you could fit probably three or four of Tony Alamo's houses in that.
Yes. And then he built this special temple there that he used for horrific,
very
horrific
special
things.
Temple. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He, you know, tell y'all what we'll talk about later. He literally built a rape room in the temple.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. It was pretty horrific. But we hear about that, but he also had places in Colorado, North Dakota, South Dakota. Like I said, there's Minnesota. Places in Mexico, Minnesota, in Canada. But one of the bigger places was that Yearning for Zion Ranch. And that's the one you hear the most about because that's what eventually became his downfall. Also in 2004, two of his nephews came forward and accused him of sodomizing them as children when he was the principal at that school. One of them filed a lawsuit against him, and the other ended up committing suicide, made the allegations, and then committed suicide. Right. But y'all have to remember, they were not making allegations against their uncle. They were making allegations against the prophet from God.
Right.
The book I read from his daughter, she dealt with it her whole life that, you know, he's the prophet from God. How would God let the prophet be like this? You know, she was abused by him her entire life from childhood into an adulthood. What surprises me about her and just makes me super respect this woman is she was abused and raised up in this cult. And then she came out the end of it and she still loves God.
Right.
Like, that's hard. How do you do that? Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, we'll talk some more about that and her story. So just as he was getting this ranch built, this Yearning for Zion Ranch and this temple and everything, he went on the run because he got put on the FBI's most wanted list.
Most wanted list. Yep.
Now,
that he did.
He was fairly far on the list. I think, what, 358 or something?
Yeah, I mean, but still, to be on that list is a pretty big deal.
Yes. You know,
there's, what, 400 million people in the United States, and to be on that list of less than 1,000 people is a pretty big deal. Puts you in, like, the top 001%.
Well, I think he was in the top 10, but he was the 358th one to be in there or something.
Right.
Either way, he was being sought after. So he was literally traveling from place to place from their different settlements. And he would sometimes they'd hear, oh, he was spotted here. He was spotted there. He was seen dedicating, you know, construction projects being done. Right. They heard that he was arranging marriages. And what he was on the list for was Utah wanted him because he married a 14-year-old girl, Alyssa Wall, to her first cousin. And, oh, I forgot to tell y'all why he wanted to go to Yearning for Zion. Listen, I'm a Texan now. I'm a converted Texan. I'm really an Arkansan who came here for you know, money.
You got here as quick as you could.
Right. But a blot in our history is the reason he came to Texas in 2004 was because the age of consent was 14.
Right.
That was one of his reasonings. So a lot of the stuff that he was doing wasn't illegal yet.
Mm-hmm.
That changed. But at the time, the age of consent was 14 in Texas.
Yep.
We talked about it in Waco. Didn't we talk about 14-year-old girls getting married at Waco? Mm-hmm. Yep. Because her parents could sign away her rights at 14 so she could marry somebody.
Right. Yep.
Or, I don't know if it's sign away rights. Whatever it is, sign so she could marry somebody.
Right.
But they had proof that he'd married this 14-year-old girl to her first cousin. Alyssa Wall also shared her story, and she said that her husband, her first cousin, basically raped her all the time because he thought he could. Because Warren Jeffs told them it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
He was finally arrested in 2006. During the whole time he was running, he was marrying other underage girls himself and to other people.
Right.
And this is where it gets a little complicated. I know we're running into our timeline here.
We are, but I have to mention, and we'll talk maybe talk about this in the theology section as well. But he had been teaching all of this time that red was the devil's color. Right? You don't wear red. You don't paint stuff red. You don't have red in your house. It's the devil's color.
Really?
Do you know what he was arrested in?
Red. Oh, it was a red
Cadillac Escalade in Las Vegas.
And the reason he was caught is because he didn't have tags on the thing.
Yep. Just a traffic stop.
I didn't know he was teaching that about the red.
Uh-huh.
His teaching started off weird, got weirder, and by the end, when we talk about that, they got real weird and real specific. Real weird.
It's still going real weird.
That's true. He's still in control of this church.
Yep.
The church is falling apart a lot, but it's still there.
All right, anyways, sorry to distract.
So he was arrested in 2006. He was convicted of being an accomplice to rape in Utah, and he was sentenced to 10 years to life in prison. Before he was convicted, though, he resigned as president of the corporation that ran the church.
Now, resigned.
Listen to how I said that. He resigned as president of the corporation that ran the church.
Right.
He said he was a sinner and was never the true president. He never said he wasn't the prophet. He even said somebody else who there was some controversy should have been. He said this to his brother in a recording that the prison made, because they record visiting, except for lawyers' visits, on purpose. And the judge was made aware of this. I think he was trying to go for some leniency.
Right.
However, the FLDS members never seen him do this. They still see him as their prophet. They never heard of this stunt because they weren't allowed to watch the news or read newspapers.
Right.
So they didn't know about any of this.
Yep.
I mentioned already about they had a business all during this time that was selling airplane parts to the U.S. government. That business made a revenue of $1.7 million. This was a big-time thing. I read estimates that the corporation retained assets were somewhere between $100 and $200 million.
Wow.
They had money.
They had lots of money.
Lots of money. And the government started, you know, when they convicted him, they started trying to pick at this stuff and get that.
Right.
And
him saying that he was never supposed to be running it was also part of a ploy to say, don't go and start looking at all that money.
Right. Right.
Yep.
So he got convicted. That was in Utah. In 2008, the Yearning for Zion Ranch was raided. Somebody made a call and said that they were an underage girl who'd been forced to get married. They were, I think, 12 and had been forced to get married. Mm-hmm. When the sheriff's office and CPS came out there, they never found the girl who made the call. It was later tracked down to some woman unaffiliated with the group in a whole other state. It was a prank call. However, they gathered up over 400 children and moved them out of there.
Right.
We'll go into more of this, but the Texas CPS treated those children horribly. They treated them like we treat the children of Mexican children today. Mm-hmm. We locked them up in cages. We separated them from their mothers. They pulled mean tricks on them to separate them from their mothers. They pulled breastfeeding babies away from their mothers. They treated them children horribly. And then in the end, they sent almost all but one back.
Mm-hmm.
And said, oh, sorry, because they got bad publicity. The same CPS that screwed up at Waco, the same CPS screwed this up too. It is ridiculous how bad it is. Anyways, I'm going to go off another rabbit trail on that one.
Yep.
It did at least get people looking at it more because of that raid.
Right.
And that's where they discovered some things. One of the things that was discovered was that Warren Jeffs kept a lot of records, and he often kept them with him. When he was arrested back in 2006, his brother was driving him in that car, and his wife, one of his favorite wives, was with him. She was his historian or his scribe. She literally went around with a notebook and wrote down everything that happened.
Everything he said. Yep. And everything that went on. Yep.
Every rape.
As if.
Every marriage. Everything good or bad he did, she wrote it down. So it was very easy to convict him of things. They never had much trouble convicting him.
Right.
Then the craziest thing happened in 2010. The Utah Supreme Court overturned his conviction. Apparently the jury instruction wasn't given properly from the judge to the jury.
Mm.
Now, at this point, he was already in Arizona facing charges there. Because remember, Short Creek's in Utah and in Arizona.
Yep.
There, they had three different people. And all three of the witnesses were no longer willing to testify. It had taken so long for him to process in Utah and all those appeals and all this to happen. They were no longer willing to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
This is 2010. Yep, so he's been in jail for 4 years. He'd been in Arizona for two of those years.
Right. So they kicked him over to Texas to let Texas handle it.
Well, they decided not to prosecute because they decided if he got prosecuted, if they could get the witnesses to, it would be less than 2 years for what they had him for. They didn't have much proof.
Yeah. Right.
But by this time, Texas had already gone in because they had gone in and done that raid, and they had some other people come in afterwards. They had found proof of this rape room. They had found proof of him marrying a 12-year-old girl and all the horrific things he did to this girl and his other wives. And because Texas had all kinds of proof. So they sent him to Texas. And Texas went after him real hard. Now, also important to know that he retook legal control of the FLDS, the corporation, in 2011.
During that 4 years in prison, he was apparently receiving revelations from Jesus.
Oh, he thought he was the whole time.
He was writing all of those down. I don't know if you can see this, but it's just...
I can see it.
Pages and pages of revelations from Jesus.
Oh, and he would send specific revelations to his people.
Warren Jeffs.
The Lord Jesus Christ says to Rachel, has a message to Rachel Jeffs about da-da-da. You've been doing so-and-so.
Yep.
And he got more and more deranged with his stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as I read through this, it's just, it's constantly just a mess. But like you said, he retook control, and this was one of the ways that he did it, right? He sent this book and had it published and printed and given to all of the FLDS and LDS and libraries
for free. So let's talk about that book for a minute.
Yeah.
So the government is, because of all these convictions, is taking over the corporation.
Uh-huh.
The property in Short Creek, they had decided to start, they took over the corporation and gave the property to whoever was living in those houses in Short Creek. A lot of which were current FLDS members.
Mm-hmm.
And they're taking his source of money. He's made the community start, and we'll go in the social issues. At that time, he's made the community go more and more communal and more eat on less and have them sign up for food stamps and take away their food stamp cards and stuff like that. And then he spent, how much did he spend on that? Was it $20 million on that book?
It was a lot. Yeah, he spent a whole bunch of money getting it out there.
It was 90% of the money that they had left.
Yep.
He had his leadership spend on getting this book made. He had the book sent to politicians, judges, prosecutors, the media, as well as his members. And it's mm-hmm. on nice paper. It's a nice book. Is that an original print?
Yeah, it's a second edition, but yeah.
It's a second
edition? I tried to get the first edition, but I couldn't.
Warner Sam is a very nice...
Couldn't justify spending the money for it.
It's a very nice printed edition that he had put out.
Yep, this is the 2012 edition.
Because he seriously thought he convinced people he was the prophet and they just let him go.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, we'll talk about it in the theology section, but I mean, he speaks not just to, you know, Texas, right? He speaks specifically to Texas as, you know, my prophet is innocent, let him go. But he's got whole sections, right? I was just reading one that was, you know, repent ye Nicaragua for your sins of blah, 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 or else an earthquake is going to come and destroy you. Which if you know where Nicaragua is, you know that it's right there along the Ring of Fire, and earthquakes happen fairly frequently. So it's just one of those things.
His prophecy came true, huh?
His prophecy most likely at this point has come true. There's probably been an earthquake in Nicaragua. But that doesn't mean that what he was trying to do was from Jesus.
Right. So let's go ahead and wrap this up on our history thing here. So
well past
he got convicted
time.
In Texas. Today, Warren Jeffs is still the leader of the FLDS. The FLDS has decreased significantly in membership. They've splintered quite a bit. Some other people have taken leadership of certain areas. Some of his his bishops, his local leaders of his different groups have taken over. But a lot of the group is still with him. He still writes letters from prison. And he runs that cult from prison to this day.
Yep.
So that's the history of the FLDS.
It is. From the start to hitting the high points. Obviously there was a lot of other little pieces in there, but these are the big things that most people, you know, can make the mental map and put things together, which is what we're here for.
So what's the next episode we're gonna do?
Next week, we're going to be talking about the theology and the things that he taught, right? Not just him, but their whole group. Things that they taught, why they taught these things, and what it generally leads to.
Well, all right. Well, listen, y'all. Thank y'all for being with us today.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you for joining us here on Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods. Don't forget that we have our website, faithfraudsfalsehoods.com, where we post a more detailed blog with references so that you can go and take a look at all of this information for yourself. Also, remember to share this with a friend and help us get the word out there for everyone else. We'll see you in the next one.